You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Peter Swanson.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories, bringing you the very best author interviews from the best writers writing today. I'd like to thank some sponsors today that make the show possible. Patricia Gillum, A Superhero's Duty, a fight between a second-generation superhero named Red Bolt and a villain-for-hire named Icarus goes terribly wrong, resulting in the drowning deaths of three innocent civilians and orphaning a six-year-old boy. Racked with guilt, Red Bolt visits Cameron Wilson at the hospital every night and won't leave the boy's side until he falls asleep. Befriended by a night shift nurse, the man in costume begins to disclose what really happened after the fight and why he feels the deaths of Cameron's parents and sister fall on his actions. A superhero didn't survive that night, and Cameron and the rest of the city aren't out of danger. A Superhero's Duty by Patricia Gillum. There's a link to it in the show notes. I'd also like to tell you about my friend Crystal Pico Watanabe of Pico's House. The Pico's House website now has a new look. Visit Crystal and her team of eight people who help her provide services to fiction authors. Crystal's full slate of services now include beta reading, manuscript critique, developmental editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Authors, you can also inquire about putting your books in her Book Lovers Box, which is a monthly digital subscription box with a different theme each month. This is free for authors for a limited time. PicosHouse.com for all your book publishing needs. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Peter Swanson back on the show with us. Peter was on last year talking about his new book at the time, All the Beautiful Lies. That book so amazing, went on to be one of my favorite books of the year. I'll tell you what, it was one of those books that I got an art copy before it came out, and read it, loved it, and then I bought the audiobook and then enjoyed it again in a whole different way. I guess last summer, probably, I listened to it and then shared it with my daughter, and she listened to it, and we had a whole father-daughter bond there over All the Beautiful Lies. So it was an amazing book. Then, as I was just telling Peter, when I saw him pop up on kind of the up-and-coming books coming up with his new book before she knew him, I knew we had to get him back on the show. Welcome back to the show, Peter.
Thanks for having me, Hank. I'm really excited to be here. We had a great conversation last time, so.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, as I've gushed on, All the Beautiful Lies was one of my favorite books of last year. How's it been going, and how has the writing been going?
The writing was good. I had a good year of writing. I think last year when we talked, I was in the middle of promoting. And this time when we talk, I'm in the middle of promoting. So, and in between doing that, you know, my life is sitting down and writing a book. So, I'm always a book ahead. So this last year has been finishing up Before She Knew Him, which was probably the first draft was written when I talked to you last year. So I'm really excited about this book, as excited as I've been in a while for a book, I think. And then I had a good year writing a new book that, you know, I'm just now starting to edit. So that's where I'm at.
I love it. Give people a glimpse into how that process works. Some folks that are, we have a pretty even split in the audience between writers and readers, and then a great mix of the two. But if someone is not familiar with kind of how the publishing industry works, when you say that you're a year ahead working on a book, tell people kind of what that process is like. You're editing the book now that will come out next year, right?
Correct. And it's about to be turned into the publishers. And this is just me, this is not everybody, but most publishers, and especially in genre, they like the authors to write a book a year. Now, not everyone can do that. And actually, I remember it's kind of a funny story, but I think after I delivered my first book, Girl with a Clock for a Heart, I then turned around and delivered my second one, I think before it came out. And my UK editor at the time said, oh, you've just blown it. He goes, you know, now we know you can write a book in a year. And I didn't really get it, but he's like, that's an expectation. So now it's my delivery date is always right around the time my book is coming out, which actually it can, well, it can be okay, but it can also be stressful because you get these two things going on at once. So I'm always talking about a book that kind of I stopped thinking about a year ago. You know, I remember it well because I spent an entire year in it.
Sure.
But the last year I've spent in a different book. So, again, this isn't everybody. There's Donna Tartt who writes a book every 10 years. And then there's, James Patterson, I'm not sure he still writes his books, but,
you've got people like Brandon Sanderson that write two or three a year.
Sure. There are definitely people, and some of them have pen names who write two or three books a year. So everyone has their time. It takes for me a year is enough. I think my publishers like it because they can put me on a schedule, and they kind of know when my book's arriving, and then they know when it can be published. And it's sort of a comfort thing for them. So I'm happy to oblige them with that. I'm a deadline guy in general. If I'm given a deadline, I work hard to make it. And so that's where I'm at. But it's always a weird thing when you're whatever you're promoting hasn't been what you've been thinking about.
Right.
Yeah. You know.
Well, when you've got a book like your brand new book is called Before She Knew Him, and I know why you're so excited about it. It's a fantastic book. But this is a book a year ago, and you probably started thinking about it, you know, a year and a half or 2 years ago. Is it fun to reconnect with the book when it's time to promote it and talk about it again after the slate's been wiped clean and you're on to something else, and then you kind of get to reconnect with these characters again?
Yeah, and in fact, I do actually. I mean, sometimes I fully read the. It's hard to fully read the book again, just because I've read it so many times. Sure. I mean, I've gone over those pages again and again and again through the editing process and through the drafting process. So, but I do dip in and out, and so I'll kind of open the book and I'll familiarize myself with everyone's names and I mean I remember what happened, but as soon as I'm reading it, I'm kind of remembering what got me into it. And around this time too, I usually write a piece. Sometimes I'm asked to do this, and sometimes I just write it on my own, which is like a piece about how did this book come about? Because I always know doing promotion that readers they're always interested in the story behind the book. And I like to kind of dig into that myself and try and remember, like, where did this story come from? How did it evolve? So I do think about that as I'm nearing promotion time.
Well, speaking of that, you know, where stories come from, there's, every writer hates to be asked, you know, where do you get your ideas from? Because ideas are everywhere. But when, sometimes there's that idea that's just a great idea that just rises above all the rest. And then a story starts just growing and evolving out of that. When that happens for you, what normally comes first, or is there a normal for you? Is it a premise, a plot device? Is it a character? What's the first thing that usually shows itself to you and then starts growing?
It's usually a premise, not the full plot, but it's usually just a starting premise without the characters. You know, a kind of what I call, or other writers call it as well, is a what if question. So, you know, for my book, The Kind Worth Killing, what if two people met on a plane and kind of got drunk and told each other all their secrets, and right, one of them confessed to murder? That's the idea. And then, of course, I build from there. I build the characters and then the rest of the plot. But so for me, it's generally a premise. Sometimes it's a crime, because I think sometimes crimes have to come first. Like, you know, this would be a way you could murder someone and get away with it. And that's the sort of the beginning of a premise of a book. It's generally a premise. And then, what I do, it's my little, I get a lot of ideas. I don't have problems with getting ideas. Probably what I have problems with is getting good ideas. So one of the things I let it do is I don't write down my ideas. I just, I wait and see if it sticks in my brain. And if it does, and I keep adding to it, I figure it's good. And eventually it will either die because I'll stop thinking about it, or I'll keep thinking about it to the point where I need to start writing about it. And that's when I know I have a book.
My wife knows when that time is, when I'm sitting around obsessing about something and I'm not talking, and she says, mm-hmm. Oh, it's that idea again, right? And that's when you know it's time to go to the computer and start working that out.
And it's a good feeling. And I think, sometimes I get the little premise pops into my head and I'm like, yeah, that's it. And then if you rush and write that down, sometimes when you write it down, you kill it. Or you write it down and then you think it's a great premise, but then it just dies in there and you stop thinking about it. And that's your mind telling you that it's not a good idea for you. You got to try. I think you kind of have to trust your obsession a little.
Right. Have you ever had an idea that maybe you write down and realize, it's not as great as I thought it was, but maybe gotten a piece later that was the key to unlocking that thing?
That's a good question. Maybe a plot idea that eventually winds its way into sort of a subplot. I say I don't write them down. I try not to. I do have an ideas folder that I haven't touched for a while, but in the past I've used it. So occasionally I go and look there, partly out of amusement, just because some of the stuff I write is really is sort of bafflingly terrible. I mean, at the time I felt inspired, you revisit them and you're like, oh, what interested me about that? And maybe that'll provide a bit of a spark for something that you're thinking about.
Yeah. Your book, last year, All the Beautiful Lies, is this really, haunting book that kind of sticks with you when the book is over. And it's a lot to do with, kind of twisted family connections and the things that we think we know. I think every family has this stuff. Maybe not to that extent, but all of us, we all have kind of broken, messed up families in one way or another. Everybody's family's weird. Do you find yourself, going back to those types of situations? Like, is family, is it always a good well to draw from?
Yeah. I mean, we are. Yeah, of course. And in fact, I think early on in my career, my agent, I think with my first book, he just told me a character kind of wasn't coming alive. And he said, write their history. I said, what do you mean? He said, just sit down, write 5 pages about their childhood and their family. And I was kind of like, oh, I don't want to write 5 pages that I can't put in the book. He's like, do it, trust me. And I wrote it, and it did bring him alive. I mean, you have to know your character's past history. You can't just know that, like, it's a plucky female reporter. I mean, you've seen plucky female reporter in books, and she can be a cliche. And that's because the only thing the author or the creator or the TV writer has thought about her is that she's plucky. But if you dig back and you think, like, why is she plucky, what was her childhood like, all this sort of thing, then you start to get into the character, and they hopefully the writing will come alive. So I do think a lot about family and what makes people the way they are, and I try and include that either in the text of what I'm writing or the subtext.
Yeah. Besides the novels that you've written, you also have written a number of short stories, some poetry, some nonfiction. You kind of spread yourself out over a lot of different forms. When you're in that one novel a year cycle, Do you sprinkle in some other types of writing just to stay fresh, or to maybe exercise some different muscles? And do you find that taking your mind off the novel for just a little bit, maybe to work on something else, helps?
No, but where it does help, no, in fact, if I can keep, once I'm in the novel, once I'm doing my word count per day, whatever I've decided that's going to be, it's generally around 1,000. If I'm doing my 1,000 words a day, I want to stay in that every day. I don't, because if I veer off and do something else, I'm going to have to go back and get back into it. I think I'm writing best when I'm writing every day and maybe even reading a little bit about what I wrote before I go to sleep. And it's kind of, percolating there all the time. But I'll tell you what I do with short stories, which is, when you're done with that first draft, sometimes I think the temptation is to instantly go back and start revising it or look at it again. And I think that's a good time. So sometimes if I have a story idea, what I'll do is I'll wait to finish the first draft. Then I'll just take myself off and give myself a week to write a story. It's a perfect break. It's a different, you know, something totally different than what I've been writing. Maybe an idea I've had, and I'm not going to worry too much about it being a perfect story. And that gives me a week or 2 weeks if I'm lucky to have this time. And then I go back to the story and I can feel like I can kind of come at it with fresh eyes. So yeah, I think other types of writing are great to give yourself a break. But in the middle of a novel, at least what works for me is doing it every day.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And that's what I was talking about between projects. Do you other things to stretch out a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's crucial, and especially between the finishing the draft and the reading process, to just give yourself a little bit of space.
I love that idea. Most writers are voracious readers, and I think that's a crucial element to learning to write and to staying sharp as a writer, is reading lots of other writers. When you're writing a book, do you read inside your genre? Do you read other books, or do you read completely different stuff? I've also met writers who say that when I'm really in the deep of it, I can barely read anything. I'm just consumed by the story. What is your reading habit like?
Yeah, I've heard that too. I know that definitely some writers don't read in their genre. I'm not that person. I'm always reading. I always have a book. I read every night, at least every night. If not, I'm not, you know, hopefully I'm reading during the day as well. And I'm often reading thrillers. I think there are maybe a couple writers with really distinctive styles that maybe I want to avoid, and the worries that I might sort of pick it up. Although I do less of that the older I get. I think I worried more about that when I was young. I don't know. I mean, he's not a thriller writer, but Martin Amis is a writer that I like to read, and he's got such this really distinctive style. And when I was younger and trying to write, if I read him, like the next thing I know, I'm writing a Martin Amis book, which is, I think, you know, it's totally fine. It's what people go through, but I'm happy to read thrillers, as I'm writing a thriller. That last 45 minutes before I go to bed is all about, just easing myself into sleep and getting into some other world that's not my own. And then the next day I'll get back into my own world. So, yeah. And every once in a while I'll read, a book that like is tackling something similar to what I want to do. Sometimes it's a technical thing, like, you know, a book will have multiple narratives. I'll be like, I'll see how they do it. Like, I'm just kind of curious how they went about it. And that can, help me thinking about, you know, how I'm crafting my book.
Yeah, I think there's something great about seeing how other people do it, and it's really weird that you can even try to mimic other writers. But if you have written for a while and you've settled into your voice, yeah. It's almost impossible to copy them. it sounds like you know, it comes off sounding like Peter trying to imitate someone else. Once your voice is established, it's really hard to break that.
I think that's, I agree. I think that's the case. I think when I was younger, I remember like in my early 20s, I had a moment of, you know, they say writers develop your own style. And I was like, oh man, what's my style? Like I kind of panicked. And then I just realized that, you know, if you're a young writer out there, just keep writing. And it's okay if you mimic someone for a little while. It's going to happen. it's impossible for that not to happen. But if you keep at it, if you keep writing, eventually I think your style is gonna pop out of you. That was my experience. I think that's most writers' experience. And then as you're saying, eventually it becomes so ingrained, you're stuck with it. But that's a good thing. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you have a new novel that's starting and like you talked about, that you begin with a premise and it starts kind of building out from there, and then characters come in and they get inserted into the premise, and then you start watching how it unfolds, as the writer. How much pre-writing goes into the book, and are you a plotter, or are you discovering the book the whole way through?
I'm discovering the book the whole way through, but with a few little caveats. I mean, sometimes I know the ending I'm reaching for. Sometimes I know certain events that are going to happen, but I don't outline, I don't pre-write. I just start writing. All the pre-writing is done in my head, and I've thought a lot about, who's going to be populating the story. And then I just start writing it and start having them talk, start having them move around rooms and see where I'm at. Every once in a while, if I get stuck in a tricky part, or I get in that soggy middle of the book, like, I'll sort of take a quick break and write down everything that's been happening. Like, do a little bit of a day-to-day outline of what's happening in the book, and see, be like, I want to reach this point pretty soon. So it's not entirely 100% flying by the seat of my pants. I actually don't think any writers do that completely. Because I'm always, it's not like it's just stream of consciousness coming out of my typewriter. I mean, I'm thinking ahead of where I want to get to, but I am allowing myself to detour and let the characters kind of draw me along the plot.
You said that when you really get into the thick of the writing, when you're at that 1,000-word-a-day spot, is that a pretty hard and fast thing that you stick to? Do you try to get 1,000 words every day?
Lately I've been up around 1,500, although I kind of try and do 1,500 Monday through Friday, and then the weekends when it's harder to find time to write, I try and do 500 each day, so it kind of averages out. Just trying to dip in and get some writing done. But I've been kind of raising my number. I mean, that's partly because I'm now a full-time writer, so I have a little more time. For my first 3 or 4 books, I was half-time still working a day job, so I was limited in the number of hours I had. So, I try and get to 1,500. I feel like anything after that, I'm kind of pushing myself, and my brain's kind of shut down. So if I get 1,500, I'm pretty happy.
Have you found that being a full-time writer has really opened up your creativity? A lot of people, when they're able to go full-time, find that the space inevitably gets filled up with all things that are about writing that have nothing to do with writing. Answering emails and doing podcasts and all this kind of stuff that you do. How do you guard that time, to make sure that you get the most out of it?
It helps to be a full-time writer, and then kind of, figure out your hours. And my hours are morning when I'm most creative. So that's when I do my writing. And then I try and save, afternoons for emails and other business related things. I mean, it doesn't always work that way, but, I'm pretty good about it. I don't think it's a huge problem for me. I mean, I know that some writers, I mean, who was that? Who did I meet? Karen Slaughter. I don't know if you've ever had her on. She, she does 3 months of promotion a year. She does an entire world tour with every book, because she's enormously popular in Europe. She's also enormously great on stage, and she's great in panels. So she likes it, but I definitely do promotion, but I'm not doing a ton of it.
Do you have a sacred writing space? Is there a space that you go to and the creativity turns on, or can you just kind of grab your laptop or whatever and go anywhere?
Well, somewhere in between. I wouldn't say my space is sacred. It's my office. it is where I do most of my writing. I don't sit at a desk. I sit on a couch, or I lay back on a couch with a laptop on my lap. But I'll move out to another room sometimes just to get a different view. And every once in a while, I mean, I sometimes go to coffee shops in the afternoon, but that's generally to do different types of writing, like emails and, you know, promotional stuff or business stuff. But every once in a while I have, with headphones, been able to do a little creative writing or definitely some creative editing in a coffee shop, which is kind of a new thing. I don't think I could do all my writing there, but I'm far too interested in other stuff that's going on.
Yeah, I have friends that only go only write at coffee shops, and to me, it's just too much chaos for me. I'm not one of these people that has to have silence or anything like that. Yeah. But there's too many things to watch or conversations to listen in on, because I catch myself like, oh, I'm going to use that little piece of dialogue or something, you know. and
yeah, yeah, I mean,
it's just kind of sensory overload.
That's why the only possibility I can do it with headphones, because otherwise, you know, the people next to me could be talking about the most banal conversation ever. And it's utterly fascinating because you're eavesdropping.
Right, just like, exactly.
You know, I mean, also, you know, writing's hard. And I'm not, you know, I'm doing a lot of procrastinating around my writing. And if you're sitting in a coffee shop, you know this, but if it's between writing your next sentence and watching someone buy coffee, you're probably going to watch the person buy coffee, because it will, then you don't have to write your next sentence. I mean, you're easily distracted. I am. I don't, the people who can sit in a coffee shop and pour all their attention into their own laptop are foreign people to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Or superheroes. I'm not sure which. They're somewhere in between, probably. Yeah. So let's talk about the new book, Before She Knew Him. When people are hearing this, it'll be available everywhere, at hardback and audiobook and Kindle edition, and all the ways that you consume books. Before She Knew Him is available. Where did the story come from, Peter?
So, funnily enough, it's a story that comes from a movie I saw a number of years ago, actually a really unsuccessful movie that came out in 1954 that I'm going to talk a little bit about it when I go out and promote it. I don't think anyone will have heard of it. It came out the same year as Rear Window, and it kind of has the same plot of Rear Window. It's called Witness to Murder, and it stars Barbara Stanwyck and George Sanders. And Barbara Stanwyck's this interior decorator in L.A. who wakes up one night and literally sees George Sanders across the building next to her, strangling a woman, reports it to the police, and the police – what makes it a terrible movie is Barbara Stanwyck is so believable. And she's – you know, if you know her as an actress, she's the type of person who – she's a straight shooter. That's the vibe she gives off. So it's ridiculous that they don't believe her. And George Sanders, if you know him, he's this oily – you know, guy who's clearly a murderer, right. Yet the police don't believe her. And, it becomes this ridiculous thing where, she's eventually put into an insane asylum because they think she keeps lying about it. And eventually they believe her, or she captures him herself. So it's actually a really bad movie. But I watched it because I was, you know, hoping maybe it was a hidden gem or something. And I started to get inspired, and I actually think inspiration can come from other art forms, like watching a TV show or reading a book. But I think the best inspiration comes from not like a great movie. Like if you watch Rear Window and get inspired by that, you're inspired by something that's already a great piece of art. I mean, where are you going to take that? But I saw this and I was like, well, there's this potential here, which is there's this brief moment in the movie where the two characters come together and the police totally don't believe her. So he's able to confess to her. He basically says, yeah, I'm a murderer. He's like, what are you going to do? Tell the cops? Like, They're never going to believe you. And of course, she screams and runs out of the room or does something like that. And but when I saw that, I was like, wow, they share something. So what stuck with me, so I thought at first, like, oh, if I rewrote this, I would do this and this and this. And eventually it became this idea for a book in a very different setting with very different characters and actually not a witness of a murder. But it eventually led me to this idea of, what if someone knew someone was a murderer, but no one would believe them? And then what if they met and they shared something that would almost be like this bizarro friendship story, because she would know this thing about – so set up my book. I'm rambling about my influence here and I'm not setting up my book, which is so in my book it's about – there's two main characters, Hen, who is an artist recently relocated to the suburbs, and Matthew, her neighbor, and early on, her and her husband and Matthew and his wife all have dinner together, and she sees an object in Matthew's house that leads her to believe that he is a murderer of a case that she followed a number of years back. But she has a history of mental health disorders, and in fact, she has accused someone in the past of a crime they didn't commit, even though she's doing fine now. So it makes her an unreliable witness. And eventually she gets to know this guy and, they form this kind of relationship based on a secret. And that was that crux, that core meeting between them is what, I really wanted to write about.
And it harkens back a little bit to The Kind Worth Killing in that you've got this story around secret telling. When you started kind of realizing that this was the story and it started unraveling, did you get that similar, that familiar feeling of, okay, I know where to go with this story?
I don't know. Cause I think I took it in very different directions.
You did. I didn't mean to insinuate that it was, a rehash, but it was a familiar feeling to me when I read it. Not that the story has anything to do with it, but I was like, okay, I immediately trusted you with the story because I've seen you do it before in a different way.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think there's something along those lines of, we have this guy and I'm not giving anything away to say that she is right and he is a murderer because you find that out in chapter two. And that is not the book is not hinged on a did he do it or did he not. And he's a guy with deep, dark secrets. And what happens when that person is allowed to tell their secrets to someone? How does that change him is an interesting idea to me. So clearly, I think some of that was explored in Kind Worth Killing and it's fascinating to me, and as is ultimately Matthew's mind and the way it works.
Right. You mentioned that Hen has a history of mental health disorders, and that becomes a major plot point of the book, becomes a major device of the book. When you're writing about a topic like that, and it becomes such an important part of the book. How do you write that authentically? And is there ever any concern that you portray people struggling with this in a clear, concise way?
Yeah, I thought a lot about it. In terms of authenticity, There are people I'm close to who have suffered from bipolar disorder two, which is the disorder that Hen has in the book. I've also read some very interesting books, like An Unquiet Mind by Kay Redfield Jamison, on this topic. And then in because of that, because it's kind of close to me as a disease, I did think about how I wanted to present it. I usually don't have sort of – it's not that it was agenda-driven, but I did think about presentation and representation. One of the things that I wanted to do was to do something different, which is I think usually when a character has a disorder of this type, like a mental health disorder, could be paranoia, could be delusions. It's often used as a plot point that would kind of lead the reader to be like, do I trust this person? Is this person seeing what they're totally unreliable? And I kind of didn't want to go in that direction. And for that reason, Hen, despite the fact that other people in her life don't believe her, she knows down deep that she's taking meds and she's doing really fine. Like she's not doubting her own mind. She knows what she's seen, and it's for her the issue is that other people won't believe her. It's not an issue of her believing herself. And I wanted to present a character with a mental health issue who was actually doing well on meds and through therapy. And then the second thing I wanted to do, which has become another cliche of sort of mental health and genre fiction, is this idea that your mental health is kind of a superpower. A couple examples I can think of, the Thomas Harris books, which I love. Will Graham is the FBI agent who initially takes down Hannibal Lecter. He's kind of loopy himself. He has this ability to totally empathize with psychotics. It puts him really on the edge of his own sanity. But it becomes the superpower that enables him to bring down Hannibal Lecter. And I think this was used again successfully in the TV show Homeland with Claire Danes as Carrie Matheson, as someone who in her manic phases has all this energy in order to track down terrorists. So I kind of wanted to get away from those two tropes and right. present it differently. Whether I did that or not, I guess is up to the readers, but that was my intention.
Well, what's really interesting is that through this situation, Matthew feels like he can let his guard down because Hen is, is an untrustworthy witness. That had to be a lot of fun to write, to play with those dynamics and then look at how you could work your twist and the things that make thrillers great, books. Where can I pull the rug out from under the reader knowing that we have this situation going on?
Right. I just wanted to take it in really unique ways. And some of that was me plotting to do that. And some of that was me getting to know the characters and having them sort of engage one another. So I ultimately Hen becomes this sort of, proxy to him that because she's unable to convince anyone that he's a murderer, she suddenly becomes his confessor in a way. She's trying to figure out, can I use this for good? Can I try and, talk him into stopping doing what he's doing or turn himself in? Or also, is this maybe a little bit fascinating to me? And is he... he's an interesting guy, and terrifying at the same time. So I liked getting them together in this situation, in this relationship. And again, as I said, that was, I think there's always the spark. There's always the thing that really gets you excited about writing a book once you have the idea of it. And that was the thing that got me really excited.
Do you ever start having, ideas of where the story could go and how you could twist this and turn that and then start writing toward those things? Do you get those kind of glimpses of the future of the story as you write?
Oh, yeah, totally. And like I said, I think oftentimes in my book I have a kind of final scene that I'm hoping to get to, like a moment. And that has changed. Sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it does. But I think it's good to stretch ahead in the way you're thinking about things and think, this would be really interesting if I could get to that. And then hopefully you can do it without it seeming contrived. I mean, that's the great tension in writing these books is to get to great moments without it feeling like you're pulling the strings to contrive them to happen, even though, of course, every piece of fiction is a contrivance with the strings being pulled. The trick is to hide that and make it seem like it's all naturally happening. And, you know, as a writer, how do you do that? It depends on the writer, I suppose.
As you're writing a book, how do you maintain the tension? And you talked earlier about getting into that kind of mushy middle. I forget the term you
soggy
used,
middle.
The soggy middle. Yeah, it's the same feeling. Yeah, it gets all squishy and soft. It doesn't feel like it's going anywhere. And your books, they definitely don't feel that way. And I know that comes with lots of editing and a book becomes the product of a lot of revision and editing and stuff like that. But, when you're writing and you get to that place where like, I don't know if the story's going anywhere, the characters are beginning to feel flat. Is there a device that you turn to, that typically tends to bring focus back to the story, amp up the energy, and keep the reader guessing?
I don't know if there's one device. I mean, it's a problem if you're a writer and you haven't had that. If you're a novelist and you haven't had that problem, then you're not telling the truth.
Yeah, then you haven't written a book.
I think there's a couple things you can do. One, I think about, like, what would surprise my characters right now? What would shock them out of complacency? And I think sometimes surprising your characters is a way of surprising readers. So it's a way to think about so you're not thinking in the contrived way of I'm going to try and surprise my readers. And then suddenly you're throwing in a strange plot point. I mean, this way you're thinking what would take the, you know, move the earth under the character's feet. So that's one way to do it. And then the second thing is sometimes, I don't know, I've heard this, I think I understand it. You've probably heard this as well, which is if something's not working at the end, go back and look in the beginning. You didn't set it up or you didn't provide the foundation. So one of the things is to maybe actually go back and think harder about those characters and think about those dynamics and their psychology. And, in other words, dig deeper. Don't get more superficial by trying to, you know, suddenly have someone enter the room with a gun and get some tension in there. Like, actually try and dig deeper into, what's going on in the characters' heads.
Is it fun, for you as a writer to take kind of this idyllic suburban scene and then show this dark thread running through it? All the Beautiful Lies had a wonderful kind of this dark undertone on top of this just really lovely little town where everybody knew each other, and it's this really unsettling juxtaposition. Is that something that you love to do because you've done it again in this book? You know that Hen is she's got this wonderful life and she has this past, but everything is, you know, she's an artist and everything's beautiful, and then the darkness comes. That's always fun as a reader. What is that like as the writer?
Yeah, that neighborhood. For whatever reason, that neighborhood just came alive to me. It's a made up name. It's West Dartford, but it's, it's similar to maybe Maynard or Acton around here in Massachusetts. I love this idea that she's coming from the city, her and her husband, and they move into sort of these little single family homes, but they're all close together, all these similar homes. And there's this initial reluctance on her part early in the book about going to the neighborhood block party. Because it'll for all the reasons that we might dread those social occasions, like it might be awkward or everyone's going to want to know why I don't have kids or I'm going to be stuck, you know, talking to people I don't really get along with. Of course, she has no idea that meeting her neighbors is going to lead to what it leads to. And that's the fun of it, right? So you take a little bit of anxiety, which is anxiety around living in a new neighborhood and getting to know your neighbors. And then you just blossom that into what if you really got to know your neighbors? And not only that, but, you know, knew them intimately and knew their monstrous secrets. So I do love that idea of a new neighborhood. I also love the idea that of the artist studio, because she's in a nearby artist studio, and around here where I live in outside of Boston, there are a lot of these open studios, they call them. They're open studio weekends where the artist sits there and people come in and out of your room and judge your art. And that's a kind of terrifying thing. But in this book, she's also exposed to, you know, anyone coming in to her art studio. And that's all I'll say about that.
And a fantastic book it is. Before She Knew Him is out everywhere now. When you're hearing this, Peter, you've done it again. This, you get me on the front cover, and then you don't let me go, you know, for 350 or so pages later. I love what you're doing. If folks are just, you know, learning about you and want to learn more about what you're doing and dig into your back catalog, where can they find you online?
You can go to my website, which is peter-swanson.com. That'll lead you, of course, to links for Facebook, links for Twitter, links for Instagram. You can also probably just search for me in those places. And that's my online presence. And then, you know, I'll be doing a few events coming up over the next few weeks. Those events will be listed, but I'll be doing a book launch reading at Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts on March 5th, and that is the day my book comes out, this coming Tuesday.
And that will be today. When people – this is going to go out on the March 5th, and when people are hearing this Peter will be at Harvard Bookstore.
My book comes out today.
Today, yes, we're time traveling
at Cambridge Book. Yes, yeah, we'll fix that.
Yes, and you're going to do a few other local events. Is that right?
Yeah. So again, you can find these on my website. But I'm going to be in Cranston, Rhode Island. I'm going to be at a bookstore called Unlikely. Bookstore out in Western Mass. I'm going to be up in Portland, Maine at the library, and a few other places that right now I'm unable to list off, but they will all be on my website.
Excellent. Peter, it's always fun to talk writing. Before She Knew Him is out everywhere today. We're going to send everybody to pick up their copy. Thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Hank. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Midnight struck. The Sandman had come. A few faint notes drifted through the rooms of 417 Gorybrook. The hollow wind testing the weatherproofing, the weak scritch of the persimmon tree against Zeph's window, and the drone of Hedwig's snoring. The old house shifted, creaked, and the shade of Agatha Van Brunt descended from the attic.
"Brahm?" she called.
The ghost paused, collecting herself on the stair. She passed a mirror, but the glass remained empty, reflecting only absence. Agatha would not have recognized herself anyway. She had been beautiful long ago, and still was, in her own mind. Not a toothless and wizened specter. Not a blue chalk sketch of a hag half erased from the blackboard of night. She drifted into the master bedroom, disappeared into a shaft of moonbeams, and reappeared on the other side. She stood over Hedwig, listening to him snore. But Hedwig was not Brahm. She needed Brahm. She slipped through the floor into Zeph's bedroom. She stood over him for a long time, listening to the persimmon tree's weak coffin scratch on the window screen.
Brahm?
No, this was not Brahm. Not Brahm, her son. But she loved this boy. So much hidden potential. He reminded her of Dylan, her grandson. Dylan had slept in this room many, many times. But Dylan was dead, never to return. This boy, Zeph, was alive, so alive.
Oh, would that he might remain so forever. Look at him. Who would consign such a handsome lad to the rot of death? Only a very cruel and blind god.
Agatha brushed her spectral lips to Zeph's cheek. He stirred, scratched the spot, and rolled into his pillow. But Zeph was not Braum. Where?
Oh, Braum is dead.
She remembered now.
Braum is dead, and so are Hermanus, my husband, and Hans, my brother, and old Baltus Van Tassel, and Katrina. All dead. Only old Agatha remains, after a fashion, to trouble the world.
Her sense of herself sharpened and returned to her. She searched the rooms for the crane boy. She sensed him. Yes, here was the boy, sleeping fitfully, holding his animal. She extended a hand as if to reach into Jason's chest and take his heart in her talons. The dog woke, sensing Agatha's presence, and growled.
Growl till your voice cracks, cur. I could kill this child myself. I could possess the man or the boy. I could take the butcher knife from the drawer. I could stride through the night in strong male form and dissect this child at my whim.
Something struck her. Something blasted her up and away from the boy. She collected her energies again and tried to re-enter, but could not pass through the walls. When she found her voice, it came as hollow and cold as wind through a tomb.
Who is here?
Agatha whispered, and her tone might have withered grass.
Show yourself.
She waited with growing confusion and anxiety. She threw herself forward and battered the door like a tempest.
Who is here?
She cried. But no one answered.